Have you ever been mistreated? I bet you have. I mean, I think it's a safe bet to say that everybody has at some point in their life been mistreated. One of the most challenging things that you ever have to do as a boss, and if you've been somebody's boss, you know this. If you've not, you can imagine with me, one of the most challenging things you have to do when you're somebody's boss is to fire somebody. And it's not like this glorified vindictive thing like it's characterized sometimes in reality TV or movies or even in books and stuff. It's a really difficult thing, especially if you have developed a close relationship with a person that you have to let go. Several years ago, is actually coming out of 2020, we had to, the church where I was at the time, we had to do this like massive staff restructuring. And that included reducing one employee from full-time to part-time, outsourcing another role, and then completely eliminating another full-time position. Because we had to reduce our budget by 15%. And what happened, and the only place we could find that 15% was in our staffing. And so what happened was we finances said, you have to make these cuts. And then mission dictated where we made the cuts, right? Where God was leading us next and who we had and what roles needed to be filled and how those roles were to be structured, that was all based on where God was leading us next. Well, ultimately, the full-time person that we had to completely eliminate the position for, it was a beloved person in the church. Like everybody in the church loved this person. Their ministry was super public, so everybody knew them. And no matter how hard we tried to clearly communicate the reasons why, there was still a lot of misunderstanding or disagreement around the decision. And that those misunderstandings led to rumors, and rumors led to accusations, and accusations led to lies. I was called, because I was this person's boss, I was called a snake and a deceiver and untrustworthy. False things were spread about me. I lost friends that I had had for decades. The tension that rippled from this whole thing lasted a couple of years. It had deep impacts on my health. Like I had physical health issues that didn't even relate to the stress until later. I developed insomnia, which I still deal with. This is 5 years ago. I still deal with insomnia from time to time. I had to go to a therapist for 6 months and develop coping strategies because this was like just wreaking havoc on my whole mental health and emotional health. It was just a really challenging season. And to be clear, like nothing was done wrong. The person didn't do something wrong to lose their job. We just had to make reductions, and he was the person who wound up having to lose his job. We handled everything right. We sent him well, gave him a really great severance package, like the whole thing. But hurt people, right? And so somebody needed to receive the brunt of the frustration and the anger and the misunderstanding and all of that. It had to be directed at someone, and I wound up being the lucky recipient of those things. Not only me, I wasn't the only one who was the target of that stuff, but I was the primary target, or so it seemed. Well, we all have a story something like this. Now, maybe you've never had to fire someone. Maybe you've never been called a snake or a deceiver. Maybe you haven't lost friends because of lies that were spread about you or false accusations that were made about you. But maybe you have experienced mistreatment through some other way, like you've been in a toxic friendship with someone who puts you down and manipulates you or makes you feel bad about yourself when you haven't done anything wrong. Maybe you've been mistreated at work, getting passed over for a promotion that you were promised or suited for, best qualified for. Maybe you were fired for no good reason, which incidentally, the person we had to let go, it's completely how that person and all of his advocates felt. Your mistreatment could come from in the form of grudges. Like maybe you made some mistakes and you apologize for those mistakes, you ask for forgiveness for those mistakes, forgiveness was given to you, but then those mistakes are held against you in the future, even though you've been told all is forgiven, and you just can't get beyond those grudges. Perhaps you've been shut out of friend groups or even parts of your family. It could even be that you've been mistreated because of your income level, because of your gender, because of your race, because of your ethnicity, because of who your friends are, because of who you associate with. Whatever the mistreatment, it's easy to lose sight of God when you're being mistreated. The tendency, or at the very least, I think the temptation, is to focus on what you're going through and how it feels. And when you're focused on yourself and how you feel, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but when you get super focused on thinking about how you feel, it gets harder to see God, to hear God, to feel God, because you're seeing yourself and you're hearing yourself and you're feeling what you're going through. And not being able to see or hear or feel God, it doesn't mean that he's not there. It doesn't mean that he's not actively working. Did you know that God is not directly mentioned one time in the book of Esther? He's not named. His name is not present once in the entire book of Esther, but he is all over that book. So we're kicking off a new series on the book of Esther today. It's a 3-week series and it's called Where is God? Over the next 3 weeks, we'll look at one of the main people from this story each week and answer the questions, where is God when I'm mistreated? Where is God when I need help? Where is God when someone needs to stand in the gap? Well, the book of Esther opens with some interesting circumstances that lead to King Xerxes. So King Xerxes, this takes place in Persia. Xerxes is the king of Persia at this time. So some interesting circumstances lead to Xerxes looking for a new queen. Let me just pause. I forgot to say this before church. I meant to in the announcement block. Let me just say this. I've been sharing like a devotional reading plan each month since the summer, and those have gone over really well. Many people in the church have expressed gratitude for having sort of a reading plan that goes along with the preaching each week. Here's what I don't have a printed thing for you, but it's really simple. Here's what I'd like to encourage you to do over the next 3 weeks. Read 2 chapters a day from Esther, 5 days a week. It's a 10-chapter book, right? 2 chapters a day, 5 days a week, each week focusing on a different character. So this week, read 2 chapters a day, Monday through Friday, and pay special attention to what Haman says and does and the activity that happens around Haman in the story, because the sermon is going to focus on Haman. And then next week, it'll be Mordecai, and then after that, it'll be Esther. So you'll read the book of Esther 3 times in the next 3 weeks, but as you focus specifically on one character, God will surface some things for you. This is what he did for me. He will surface some things for you that maybe you've not noticed before. And you'll see the story in like this whole different light. I believe that mostly because that's my testimony. I've studied Esther a few times over the last year, and it's just, man, this book is rich. And I want you to be able to experience that too. So there's your same page reading plan for the next 3 weeks, right? 2 chapters a day from Esther, 5 days a week, focusing this week on Haman. Okay, so back to the story. The circumstances at the beginning of Esther find King Xerxes looking for a new queen. And he finds that queen in this beautiful Jewish woman named Esther. So Esther becomes the queen. Her cousin Mordecai learns about this plot. So Mordecai raised Esther. So they're very closely connected in this story. Well, Mordecai learns about this plot that these guards are talking about to murder King Xerxes. And so he gets word to Esther that there's this plot to kill the king. Esther gets word to the king, and his life is saved. Well, in the meantime, the king has this like right-hand man named Haman who like rises to this position of super high authority. And Haman, because of this position of authority that he holds, he thinks he's really big stuff. As a matter of fact, he thinks so highly of himself that he thinks everywhere he goes, people should bow before him in an act of worship. Like, I am so much above you that you ought to bow before me. And everybody does, except for Mordecai. Mordecai refuses to bow before Haman. And this is where the mistreatment begins. It would violate God's law to worship a man, so Mordecai refuses to worship. Now, it doesn't come right out and say that in Esther because that would be directly referencing God, right? But we know that Mordecai is a Jew, and we can read from elsewhere in the Old Testament that, like, I mean, Ten Commandments, number one, have no other gods before me. You cannot worship anyone else, only the one true God. And to bow before a man would be worshiping a man. And so we know, because Mordecai is a Jew, that he can't worship. He stands on that belief and he does not worship. And that makes Haman hate Mordecai because he's like, no, this is wrong. You should be doing what everybody else is doing. Bow before me. Well, to further frustrate Haman, the king eventually finds out about this plot to kill him, but he didn't know who thwarted the plot to kill him before. He just knew, like, it didn't happen, right? So then somebody's reading through the records of what had been happening to help Haman fall asleep, and he reads about this plot to kill him, and he's like, who is it to save me? It was Mordecai, the Jew. He's like, well, I want to honor Mordecai, the Jew. Have Haman, my right-hand man, come in, and I'm going to brainstorm with him the best way that we can honor this man who saved my life. So Haman comes in. This is like straight out of a sitcom. It's one of those situations where, like, the king doesn't say the name. And so Haman thinks he's talking about him, but the king's actually talking about Mordecai, right? So he's like, hey, what should I do? This is King Xerxes. There is a man that I want to honor. I want everyone to know that I hold this man in very high esteem. What can I do to honor him? And Haman is like, oh yeah, he's got to be talking about me. There's no one else possible that the king could want to honor as much as he would want to honor me. So he's like, so here's what you should do, king. You should put him on a royal horse. You should dress him in all these fancy royal clothes. And you should parade him around town and get everybody's attention, focusing on him, all hailing him and praising him and talking about how amazing he is. And Xerxes is like, I like it. That's a great idea. Go and do that for Mordecai. And so then Haman has to go and lead the guy that he hates around town on this royal horse while everybody who has been bowing before him is watching him serve the man he hates, leading him around town on this horse. And that's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. Haman is so mad. He goes home and he complains to his wife and his friends. And his wife is like, here's what you should do. You should set up a 75-foot tall pole in your own courtyard and arrange to have Mordecai impaled on the pole. And he's like, well, that sounds like a great idea. So he has this pole set up. And in the meantime, as he's meditating on how much he hates Haman and the fact that Haman is a Jew, he extends guilt by association. He extends that hate to all Jewish people in the 127 provinces that King Xerxes ruled over. And he works up this edict. He gets the king to sign this decree giving him permission to kill every Jew in the 127 provinces. Mass genocide. He convinces the king that the Jews are a threat to you and they should be taken care of. And just to make sure Haman got what he wanted, he offered to bankroll the whole thing himself. Haman is like, I will pay for it. Won't cost you a thing. I will pay for it. I will get my troops. We will go take care of it. All of the Jews will be gone. You will be able to continue to reign without any issue. Well, Mordecai has this knack for being able to find out plots, right? So like Mordecai, he actually hangs out kind of by the gate of the palace. And apparently the guards at the gate of the palace just like to talk about things. And Haman hears them. And so he finds out about this plot to commit mass genocide against all of the Jews. He gets word to Esther again to get word to the king. So Esther goes to the king, and by doing so, you'll see this as you read through the whole book of Esther this week. But by approaching the king without a personal invitation, Esther's actually risking her own life because there was a rule that you cannot approach the king without unless it's at his request. And if you do, then like he'll take your life. And so she approaches the king, and she actually does so in the presence of Haman. So she arranges this banquet. And so like Haman gets invited in. And again, Haman is like, I'm a really big deal. I'm going in front of the queen and the king. They must want to honor me. And so he goes into this thing Esther has told the king right before we're going to pick up here in chapter 7, told the king that there is this plot to kill all of the Jews in your whole kingdom. And here's the thing, Your Majesty, I am a Jew. These are my peoples. Up until this point, the king didn't even know that his queen was a Jew. And so he's not happy. This is where we pick up. Chapter 7, starting at verse 5. We're going to read 5 and 6, and then we're going to jump ahead to 9 and 10. Who would do such a thing? This is a king's response to Esther. Who would do such a thing? King Xerxes demanded. Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you? Not just hurt you or try to kill you, but even to touch you. Esther replied, "This wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy." Haman, because remember, he's present at this moment. Haman grew pale with fright before the king and queen. Aw, snap. I was just caught. Jumping ahead to verse 9. Then Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, "Haman has set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. He intended to use it to impale Mordecai, the man who saved the king from assassination." The king replies, "Then impale Haman on it," the king ordered. So they impaled Haman on the pole that he had set up for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. And this is where, like, there's only 10 chapters in Esther, right? The last three chapters, everything, all of the mistreatment, not only against Mordecai, but all the Jews, it all starts to reverse. Haman, the adversary and enemy of the Jews, is defeated by the very instrument he intended to use to claim his own victory. Like I said before, God isn't explicitly named in the book of Esther, but that doesn't mean that he's not actively working in it. Haman is the person in the story we're focusing on this week. So just here's a super quick recap of Haman's activity. Haman is called our adversary and enemy. Haman wants to be worshiped and he hates Mordecai for refusing. Haman plans on impaling Mordecai on a pole. Haman's plot is ruined and he's defeated on that same pole. So where is God in all of that? Well, the word Satan means, literally in Hebrew, it's pronounced Satan. It means adversary or enemy. The word Esther used to identify Haman is the same word that we have as the name of the devil. The adversary, the enemy. Satan wants to be worshiped and he hates those who refuse. Satan plans for Jesus to be nailed to a cross, impaled on a pole, so to speak. And Satan's plot is ruined, it's my favorite part, and he is defeated on the very instrument that he intended to be for his own victory. When you look at God's, when you look for God's activity in Esther, you discover that Haman is a kind of archetype, a picture, an image of Satan. And his role in this story foreshadows what would happen thousands of years later in the future, not just for Jews under the rule of King Xerxes, but for all people everywhere. The Bible is, I've said this a million times in the last almost 3 years, the Bible is one big story that points to Jesus. When you look for God's activity in the book of Esther, you see Jesus all over the story of Esther. In this life, you will be mistreated. Will your mistreatment include murder plots and conspiracies and genocide and threats of being impaled? In 2026, Eaton Rapids, Michigan? Probably not. But that does not trivialize the mistreatment that you have faced, and it does not trivialize the mistreatment that you will face. In the story of Esther, Haman is the primary perpetuator of mistreatment. As the Satan figure in the story, does that mean I'm saying that every mistreatment you face is from Satan? No, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what it means at all. we want to be careful not to give Satan more credit than he's due. You can over-spiritualize things and you can under-spiritualize things. And there's a balance in this. There are troubles in our lives. There are things that even experiencing mistreatment from others that the devil certainly has his hand in, but the devil does not necessarily have his hand in every single misstep or unfortunate circumstance in our lives. So like, be on guard, but don't give the devil more credit than he's due. I was mistreated after our staff restructuring because, like I said before, hurt people hurt people. I think that is an understandable human response, an emotional response to a very difficult situation for that person. I don't think that it was the devil. I think the devil had an opportunity to do something with that and cause problems in my life and in their lives, but I don't think that's where it started. I think it started from human emotion. If you're getting a speeding ticket, that's not the devil plotting your mistreatment. It's just maybe not paying attention to the speed limit signs or paying attention to them and choosing to go too fast anyway and then getting caught, right? Like, it's probably not the devil. You got food poisoning? Probably can't blame the devil for that either. Sometimes we make bad choices and we suffer consequences. Sometimes people just treat us badly because they have unresolved issues or trauma from their past and they're taking it out on you on purpose or without even realizing that they're doing it. Sometimes people just don't know how to have healthy relationships with other people and you wind up being mistreated as a result of that. Or maybe you're the one who's mistreating other people because you just don't know how to have healthy relationships with others. Sometimes our relationships with others are messy simply because we live in a world that is suffering the effects of sin and rebellion against God. And that works its way into how we interact with other people. So no, not every mistreatment is from the adversary, but the adversary will leverage your trouble to throw you off your praise game. He will leverage mistreatment to encourage you to question the presence of God and the activity of God, or to cause you to stumble in your faith. I want to be super, super clear about this next point. The enemy's goal is not to make your life miserable. That's not what the devil is up to. We kind of do a pretty good job of that all by ourselves, like left to our own devices, right? His job, his goal is not to make your life miserable. The adversary's goal is to prevent you from spreading the kingdom of heaven here and now and distracting you from God by getting you to focus on being mistreated by other people is one of his strategies. Got great news, though. You know why the devil shows up as a garden? Not as a garden. You know why the devil shows up as a snake in the Garden of Eden? It's because he's already been defeated. Badoonks. Yeah, get it? Snakes don't have feet. Like, defeated. That was a really bad pun in the middle of a very serious moment, but I couldn't resist. Yeah, the devil shows up as a snake in the Garden of Eden because he's already been defeated. But there's truth in that. Like, the devil, right out of the gate, the curse that is spoken over humanity, like the snake will strike your heel, but the heel will strike the snake's head. Like, that's Jesus having victory over the devil. It's foreshadowed. It is prophesied in the very opening pages of the whole Bible. The devil has already lost. God's grace gives you the ability to walk in the victory that Jesus won impaled on that pole. Satan has no power over you. I'm going to say that again. Satan has no power over you for those who have given their lives to Christ. So do not ascribe to him that which he does not possess. The devil has no power over you because greater is he who is inside of me than he who is in the world. Satan's authority has been stripped away from him because when Jesus died on that cross, he descended to the land of the dead. He took the keys. We read that in Revelation. And he rose back up again in new life to give new life to everybody who follows him. Satan has no authority over your life. You can bow to him and let him dictate how you feel, but you have no obligation to that because he has no power over you because Jesus has already won. But what about when the hits keep coming? What about when I get stuck in a rut and I can't see God or hear him or feel him? What about when it feels like he's turned a deaf ear or he's ignoring me or he's punishing me? Well, this is the image that God gave me as I was thinking about these questions, because this is real life. Like, I can stand up here and I can like preach my head off and preach my heart out. And Lord willing, you walk out of here feeling invigorated and encouraged, and then life has a way of slapping us across the face. So what happens in those cases? Here's the picture. Have you ever been sunburned on a cloudy day? Like, you go outside and the sky is not brilliant blue. The sun is not blazing up here where you can see it and you're squinting because it's so bright. It's just this kind of hazy, whitish, grayish kind of thing. So you don't think about putting on sunblock. You don't think about putting on a hat. You don't think about putting on like a sun shirt or something. You don't think about going inside periodically to get out of the sun. You don't think about looking for shade. There's no sun in the sky, so I don't have to worry about those things, or they don't even cross my mind. So you spend the whole day doing whatever you do outside all day long, working in your yard, gardening, going for walks, hanging out at the beach, whatever. Fill in the blank with your favorite summer activity. And then at the end of the day, you're brushing your teeth in front of the bathroom mirror and you look in your reflection and your nose is glowing like Rudolph and your ears are bright red and you're if you're like me, your whole scalp is just blazing, you know. You're like, wow, how did I even get sunburned? I didn't see the sun all day. Well, the sun was still there. And it was still doing its thing. It was still putting off light and ultraviolet rays. It was still cooking your skin while you were outside, even though you couldn't see it. And that's how God works sometimes. Like, just because you can't see him doesn't mean he's not there. Just because you can't see him doesn't mean that he's not actively working, doing his thing. That's how he is through the whole book of Esther. We tend to, in our faith, we tend to focus on two kinds of stories with God. We focus on the great big miracles, and we focus on the surprising ways he shows up in small things. I have preached series on both of those things. One was very recently about Gideon. Like, God does big things through seemingly small means, right? But Esther is not a story of a burning bush or flooding the world or shaking the earth or splitting the sea or pillars of fire and smoke, angels on a hillside, dead people rising from their graves. It's also not a story of a still small voice or a baby in a manger or slaying a giant with a stone or toppling a wall with trumpets or being healed by touching the hem of a garment, like a big thing through seemingly small means kind of story. This is a story that reflects how God is working in the background, aligning circumstances, working for the good of his people in holy moments and seemingly mundane ways, when it's easy to see and when you have to go looking for him. Because God's presence is not dependent on your awareness. If God was only present when you're aware of him being present, then God would not be faithful. God would not be constant. God would not be dependable. If God was only present when you were aware of him, then you would not need faith. He would be like a genie that shows up when you rub the lamp. That is not our God. He is always there. He is always faithful. He is always ready. He is on your side and by your side, working all things together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose as we are transformed daily into the image of his son. The enemy is a thief who comes to steal, kill, and destroy. When he does, do not allow him to distract you from the fact that God is always there, He is always working, and Christ has already won. That means when you are mistreated, and you will be, by God's grace through faith, in Christ, you will not be defeated. So imagine for just a moment, imagine what your home and your neighborhood and your family and your city would be like if we all learned to see that God is not only in the extraordinary, but he's also in the ordinary. What if we all started looking for him throughout the day, every day? How would that change the way we see the people we know and the people we don't know? Our daily commute, how we care for our homes, how we react to how others treat us, how we treat other people. Like, how would that shift if we just remembered every day, if we developed a consciousness that God is present all the time, how would that shift the way we see and interact with the world? Well, here's my invitation and challenge for you this week. It's a prayer habit that I picked up a while ago and have to pick up again and again because it kind of falls out of habit for me. And so I've just recently started doing it again, and it's so helpful. When you pray, whenever you pray, for me, it's right around 6 o'clock in the morning, right? So maybe for you, it's first thing in the morning. Maybe it's last thing before you go to bed. Maybe it's periodically throughout the day. Maybe it's every time you're in your car. Maybe, I don't know, whenever it is, whenever you pray, maybe it's multiple times throughout the day, right? Pick a time when you pray and just ask the Lord to show you where he was present over the last 24 hours. So for me, I'm like, okay, it's, you know, 6 a.m. So going all the way back to 6 a.m. yesterday, God, where were you present? In the places that I saw you and heard you and felt you, but also in the places that I didn't notice. I'm going to look for you now. Hindsight is 20/20. Show me where you were working. And then just thank him for the ways that he was present that you did or did not even recognize. And then the next day when you pray, do it again. And then do it again. And then do it again. The more we go to the Lord and say, show me where you were present, even when I didn't realize it, maybe especially when I didn't realize it, the more we start seeing him every day. The more we realize his presence every day. And the more we see it, the more we walk in it, and the more we walk in it, the more our lives are changed.